Okay, we're going to have the Sunday feast program. It's not going to be a normal Bhagavad Gita class today. It's going to be on Life Comes from Life. It's a presentation I did several years ago. For those of you online, may not have seen it. And it's dealing with where does life come from? Does it come from a combination of matter? Or does it come from a soul, the combination of the soul and matter? So anyway, it's going to be an interesting presentation. It's going to be scientifically based, and we're going to define science for all of you. And let me make sure everyone can hear me. Yeah. Let me just mute everybody so they don't have to hear everybody as they talk to themselves. Okay, is everyone ready? I guess we're ready. So first we'll chant Jai Radha Madhava. And as you know, we're doing the programs in the temple now. And big turnout. Because everybody else is online. We got quite a few people online. We got 16 people so far there. And a few on Facebook, so it's not that bad. Where's my phone? Is my phone over there? Why don't you give me the phone? Because I want to text everybody, tell them I'm online. All right. Okay. Everybody. So, we'll start. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi Jana Balaba Giribaru Dhauti. Gopi jana vallabha giribhara dhauti. Yasoda nandana prajajana randavunda. Yasoda nandana brajachana ranjana. Jamuna te rabana chakti. Yamuna te rabana chakti. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi jana palaba giri badhauti. Gopi jana palaba giri badhauti. Y
Yasunanandana Brajachana Ranjana. Yasunanandana Brajachana Ranjana. Jamunati Rabana Chahuti. Yamunate Rabana Chahuti. Jaya Radhu Madhava Kunjabi Hahuti. Jaya Radhu Madhuva Kundabi Halti.
Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahansa Paravidakacharya All Suteta Sutashi Shimad His Divine Grace Abhaya Chananada Bhaktivedanta Goswami Srila Prabhupada Kichai ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Kichai Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrindi Kichai Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Kichai Prem Se Kaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Chitvaita Gadadha Shivasati Gaura Bhakta Vrindi Kichai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopa Gopinath Shyam Kun Radhakunda Giri Govardhan Kijai Vrindavanam Kijai Maturadam Kijai Jagadatha Sami Kijai Yamunamai Kijai Shrimati Lasi Devi Kijai Samaveda Bhakta Vrindi Kijai Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bo. All glories the assembled devotees, all glories the assembled devotees, all glories the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada Kijai Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swamini Namini Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nivashesha Shunyavadi Paschacha Dejatarni. So, by popular demand, and some of the devotees who didn't have, let's say, complete faith that life comes from life, we're doing this presentation again. I think we did it about 3 years ago about Life Comes From Life. It's a multi-part presentation. The first part is based upon irreducible complexity, and that's not the part we're going to do right now. And mostly the presentation to prove Srila Prabhupada's point, because we're doing this to serve Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada convinced us that life comes from life. We're going to just be using mathematics and science. So you can't accuse us of being fanatical religionists or anti-Darwinists or anti-scientists, so which is what people generally say. Because it's interesting, people have this weird definition of science, and we're going to talk about a definition of science in a second. Anyway, so Om Ganat Vedanta Shah Garanjana Shalakaya Chakshur and Meditam Yena Tasmai Shikanabe Namaha. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of my spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, who so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was blinded in the darkness of ignorance. So people have this really unusual definition of science. They generally think that science is something that's empirical or can be proved empirically. And that's not really what the scientists themselves say. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But anyway, so let's continue with this because it's rather lengthy. I'm going to first make reference to Shastra. So hopefully you don't think I'm a fanatic Hare Krishna when I make reference. Satyam apratishtam te jagadarhur anishram aparaspara sambhutam kimanyat kamahaitukam. They say that this world is unreal with no foundation, no God in control. They said it is produced of sex desire and has no cause other than lust. In other words, the genetic combinations that occur between two living entities, particularly we're talking about sexual reproduction rather than asexual reproduction. Asexual means like an amoeba. It can reproduce itself. But then you just simply have the same
genes and everything like that. They just have duplicates. Of course, you get mutations there, too, which we're going to talk about. So, anyway, so then you have these combinations, mutations, and basically they say that life began because of some chemical combination, particularly as scientists talk about a reducing atmosphere, which means methane, for those of you who don't know. And there was a spark, and then all of a sudden you had the proto-life, which was some amino acid. And the scientists have not been able to duplicate that in spite of having all the materials and everything like that. They have not been able to produce proto-life. They can put together two life forms or amino acids, or they can build an amino acid themselves, but they haven't produced life themselves. So there's several arguments against materialistic evolution or in favor of life coming from life. And one is called irreducible complexity, which we're not going to deal with today. Not completely, but indirectly. And I think all of you, or many of you, may remember the example I gave of a mouse trap. That a mouse trap is actually irreducibly complex, because if you take one part of the mouse trap away, it doesn't work, and it has to be all assembled in a particular order. That's irreducible complexity, and life is irreducibly complex. And with that particular presentation, which is our first presentation, we show the flagella of paramecium and spermatozoa, and showed that how it was a motor with many different parts. And if you took away one part, the motor wouldn't work. And each and every part of the motor had to be assembled in a particular order for it to work. And there had to be a mechanism to assemble the motor in a particular order. So you got all this irreducibly complex stuff in the cell and in all living entities. I mean, for example, if you go into a cell, and I hadn't planned on talking about this, but I will briefly give you an overview. If you go into a cell, each cell is more complex than all the cities in the world combined. And you got all these little, even creatures in the cell. There's this one interesting creature called the kinesin. I'm not saying it's a person, but it's a mechanism in the cell that walks on 2 feet, and it carries cellular garbage from one part of the cell to another, and carries, you know, energy and does things. You know, it's like a servant of the rest of the cell. So that's just one part of the cell, but we're not going to talk about kinesins, which is my favorite part of the cell. And then you have forces of nature. Forces of nature means basically that you have certain universal constants that are there, and if these universal constants, I'm not going to get into detail about it, were adjusted even a little bit, you wouldn't even have anything sticking together, you wouldn't have anything. So you see everything adjusted perfectly, especially on this Earth planet. We are a perfect distance from the sun. The moon is a perfect distance from us. And if you adjust any of those things, you know, hey, we're gone. And so information in life, that's really what we're going to talk about today. Information theory. Information theory involves like probability theory. What is the probability of something occurring? I'm sure that some of you study this in the university. I remember taking one course in probability, and they said that enough monkeys, if they typed away at typewriters for enough time, they'd come up with the works of William Shakespeare. Anyone's heard that before? I mean, that's a standard thing they teach in probability theory. And so let them try that. I think if you actually calculate, they would have to type probably for the whole span of the universe before they came up with even Romeo and Juliet, what to speak of the whole works of Shakespeare. But anyway, if you did a probability analysis of it. And then there's the chicken and the egg thing. We're not going to talk about that. That's rather simplistic. You know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? But that's really too simplistic for us today. So we have two options in deciding where life came from. Life is either design, like you see here, or it came about by chance. And the dice represents chance. Chance evolving due to, survival of the fittest, chance mutation, all that other stuff. And there's a lot of problems with that particular theory. So, of course, first we're going to talk about epistemology. Epistemology is How do you really know something? How do you know what you know? And there's different methods of knowing things. One method is called pratyaksha, which means directly perceiving. And for example, like I directly perceive Kunjabihari's body there. So, but that can be faulty too, because I can see things, especially in my dreams, that don't exist. And sometimes I cannot see things that do exist. You know, it's very a faulty type of understanding or coming to a philosophical or a scientific conclusion. And of course, along with pratyaksha, you have another, this of course is a very, this is basic epistemology. Then you have something called anuman, in which you examine different instances. Scientists use this all the time, and then they come up with basic theories based upon a limited number of circumstances. I mean, for example, the scientific experimentation. For example, they're doing this on the vaccine right now, different vaccines. They're having controlled experiments. And based upon, let's say, 50,000 people whom they give the vaccine to, they're going to come up with particular conclusions. Is it safe? And does it work? Right, those two things. Or is it safe for old people? Or is it safe for young people? So, but this is also an imperfect method of achieving knowledge, because there may be the 50,000th and one person who dies. So it may not be safe, but basically I think they're doing enough studies that we'll be assured of this safety. But it's not absolute surety. It's relative surety. It's relatively sure. The third method of achieving knowledge is called shruti, means hearing from authority. Prabhupada would sometimes give the example that if you wanted to know who your father was, you would ask your mother. Of course, nowadays, I don't know if that works. There was that one story, Satyakama in the Vedic literatures, where Satyakama wanted to take initiation, and he had to be a Brahmin to take initiation from Gotama Rishi. And so Satyakama's mother was, let us say, a little loose. So basically he went to Gotama Rishi and he said, I want to be your disciple. And Gotama Rishi says, you have to be a Brahmin to be my disciple. And he asked Satyakama, what is your father's name? You know, and that's how he would identify himself as a Brahmin. So he went to his mother and he asked his mother, what was my father's name? Or what is my father's name? Because he never met his father. And his mother said, it could have been him, or maybe them. So anyway, so he goes back to his guru and he says to his guru, my mother said she doesn't know. And he said, you're a Brahmin because you're telling the truth. Anyway, so Prabhupada gave the example that we want to know who our father is, we ask our mother. So in the same way, generally that should be the authority. So if we want to know the absolute truth, not just relative truth or guess at the truth using imperfect methodologies such as direct perception or induction, anuman is induction, then we should go to someone who knows the truth. And of course, the best person to know the truth is Krishna. There's this interesting statement, dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam, which means dharma can only be, perfect dharma can only be elaborated on by God and those who repeat the words of God. So that is our method of receiving knowledge. It's called shruti, to hear from the Vedic literatures. Now let's talk about evolution. And this is a little complex for most of you. We all heard of Sir Charles Darwin, who wrote his wonderful book, Origin of the Species. And he went to this place, Galapagos, which I hope to go to one day and see the finches that he looked at. And anyway, You can go. You can visit. They limit the people who can go there. It's an isolated place. So anyway, so he came up with this Darwinian theory of evolution, which was based upon natural selection. You know, weather patterns changing or industrialization, such as in the case of England, which at one point had a lot of soot, another point didn't have a lot of soot, and the moths actually turned black or white. But, you know, we're not against natural selection. It obviously works, you know. But we're not saying that natural selection causes the diversity of species, but it can cause diversity within species. I mean, for example, nowadays you see that people, this coronavirus is affecting people with darker skin more than it affects people with lighter skin. And the reason for that is that people with darker skin are getting less vitamin D than the people with lighter skin. And it's shown scientifically, and I'm a scientist, it's shown scientifically that if you have enough vitamin D in your system, it's very likely you will not succumb and die from the coronavirus. You know, so different types of bodies are more acclimated in different circumstances. You understand that? That's practical. Like if you were not an Eskimo and you started to live in Alaska, you'd be in trouble, probably. And if I try to live, let's say, in the jungles of Africa, I'll be in trouble too. Not just from the animals. So anyway, that's Darwin, you know, inheritance, natural selection. He didn't really understand the mechanism for natural selection or inheritance or whatever like that, because they didn't have microscopes, at least electron microscopes at that time. They had microscopes, but not anything so sophisticated they could peer within the cell. And the discovery of DNA and RNA came much later with Francis Crick. So anyway, so nowadays you have this neo-Darwinism, and they've come up with so many varieties of this evolutionary theory. And I'm not going to explain all these. These are really, this punctuated equilibrium, I don't even think it's mentioned here, population genetics. One thing that's interesting is epigenetic inheritance. That means your environment actually influences how the genes express themselves. Doesn't change the genes, but it changes the expression of the genes, you know, which genes actually act and which genes don't act. So, anyway, but it all involves mutations and survival of the fittest if you happen to have a good mutation. You understand? And some of you may have seen the movies about the mutants, the X-Men, and things like that. Generally, you don't find people like that with powers, you know, even though you've seen it in the movies. You haven't seen the movie? You know. All right, everybody's in Maya here. Anyway, so basically, you're talking about undirected natural forces, which cause, and somehow there's a mutation because you had radiation or some other stress, or just because there's imperfect copying of the genes. And then natural selection means survival of the fittest. And so we see here an example, a nice example of mutation. So the unfortunate thing or fortunate thing is that most mutations, and this is brought out by a scientist, and this is a whole other presentation I'm not going to do today. There's this great scientist, Michael Behe, who's considered to be the father of the intelligent design movement. And he just published a book called Darwin Devolves. I can mention a little bit about the book right now. And he showed using analysis, you know, scientific analysis, he's a scientist. These are all scientists, not religious people. Well, they do believe in God, thank God. But he shows that 99% or more of the mutations result in a degradation of the genetic code. In fact, and this may be scary to all of you, that human beings are actually degenerating from one generation to another. This is very much in line with what the Vedic literatures talk about, you know, Kali Yuga, how that with each succeeding generation, there's more damage to the genome. And he goes into detail showing on the average how many genes get damaged and how much loss of functionality there is between each succeeding generation. And then he does a projection showing how in, yes, a few thousand years, we're going to be in really bad shape. And so instead, by the laws of chance, mutation, instead of evolution, we actually see evidence of de-evolution if one looks at it in terms of the genes. Now, there's more to heredity than genes. But still, if you just look at it in terms of the genes, you know, the DNA, of course, the RNA, the messenger RNA, and the transport RNA, all that other nice stuff, transfer RNA, then you'll see that basically human beings degenerate. And that, and actually, there's examples of bacteria that are resistant to different antibiotics because they missed part of their genome. It was actually mistranslation, part of the genome. The hairless chihuahua, in case you like dogs, is hairless because his genome is damaged. And, you know, then you reproduce him because everybody likes a hairless chihuahua. So, I don't. We used to have one, and he used to bite me all the time. Chihuahuas have one of the worst temperaments of any dog you could imagine. Every time I go near him, if he had a bone, he would, rah! You know, he would think himself like 10 feet tall. In fact, he was only rather small. Sometimes smaller people get angrier than taller people. Anyway, so we're talking about mutations. Okay, let's go ahead before I get off track. So let's define science. Like, many people think the definition of science is, you know, what you can perceive, what you can prove. But actually, according to Webster, who is the authority on definitions, science is the state of knowing knowledge as distinguished from ignorance or misunderstanding. You know, so, but there's different methods that scientists use. Let's talk about scientists themselves. Scientists do not only use the method of experimentation, you know, controlled experiments and everything like that. Another method they use is the method of observation, which you see here. Observation means, let's say, if you can't experiment on something, then just observe it. And you can't experiment on the stars, obviously. You have to observe it. Either you observe through different electromagnetic spectrums, and you analyze it with a computer, and you speculate as to what's happening on the star. You know, you could speculate as to how fast it's moving away or towards you or sideways. You can speculate on what it's made of because you can see the spectrum. Different elements produce a different spectrum of light. And so the speculation. They don't know for sure. They're actually assuming the same laws of physics apply, you know, many, many light years away that apply here. And, of course, they have many unanswered questions such as, you know, dark energy, you know, things like that, dark energy or whatever. So the scientists, half of the scientists, that is at least the astrophysicists and those observing things they can't manipulate, use the inductive method, which we talked about before. They speculate as to the best conclusion. Actually, both of them use inductive method, whether they use controlled experiments or they just observe. So in order to understand how life evolved, we have to use the second method of observation. So we observe present phenomena. We can't observe the past. I mean, somehow, or you know, I guess archaeologists can dig up in the earth and find some remnants of the past. However, Archaeology is not an exact science, as my godbrother Drew DeKarma has pointed out. There's a lot of anomalous evidence that comes up in the strata in the earth. You know, they may find fully formed or skeletons or footprints of fully formed human beings millions of years old. And they speculate sometimes, well, maybe they were buried in the strata, but you don't find evidence of a burial. You just find them intact in a strata means a level of the rock that's actually millions of years old. And there's different periods in the levels of rocks, and particularly one area that's very interesting to us is called the Cambrian era. And that's an era in which life appeared just like that, without anything happening before it, which is really interesting. And the evolutionists cannot explain the Cambrian explosion. It's called the Cambrian explosion. Anyway, don't worry about that. It's another subject matter. So the fossil record doesn't contain information about transitions, just variations within a species. So the way scientists develop theories is to examine, at least the scientists who are observing things, is to examine possible causes of an historical event. You understand what I mean? Like whether you're an archaeologist or anthropologist, you have to speculate. You have the historical event, or you think it's an historical event. You're not even sure about that. And then you have to backtrack, you know, go in your time machine. What type of car do they use in the time machine? The DeLorean or something? The DeLorean. So you have to go in your back to the future. So you have to go in your time machine and try to fit. No, you don't have a time machine. So you have to speculate how it came about. How did the different species come about? So there's many different theories, but nobody's actually seen the species, one species develop into another species. I mean, sure, you can crossbreed different animals and different plants, you know, beginning with Luther Burbank. Some of you may have heard about him. He used to crossbreed plants and come out with better plants, which is all right. We're not objecting to that. And you can crossbreed human beings if you want, and come out with a Superman if you want to do that. So, or you can genetically modify a human being, or you can, in the future, you're going to be able to order babies. That would be cool, isn't it? Then you just say, you know, I want someone who's going to be a good sannyasi, a good devotee. And you just pick all the characteristics of all, you know, anyway, you go into the, well, I want to say you should go and take genes from the devotees who have passed away. And then you get this perfect devotee, you know, and strong as Arjuna and intelligent as Vedavyasa. Anyway. So, joking aside, so this is how scientists come up with theories, including the theory of evolution. They don't see it happening, but they speculate on it based upon present evidence. Everyone understands it? And then they cross out the evidence that really there's contradictions to, it doesn't make sense, and they do something called inference to the best explanation. This is a scientific method. It is not religion. Say, this is a scientific method. You understand? They infer. Infer means they don't see directly, but they infer based upon the evidence that they've seen. And they come up with, of course, we come up with ID, which means intelligent. So here's a scientific method. Here are the facts. What conclusion can we draw from them? That's exactly what goes on with historical stuff. Here are the facts. Here's what we see. Here's the data. What conclusion can we draw from them? Simple. You know, whether it's something that happened in the past or something that will happen. You know, they're looking at bones here in this particular cartoon. So even Charles Darwin said something very, very interesting. He said, it seems to me that supposing that such a hypothesis were to explain such general propositions, we ought, in accordance with the common way of following the science, to admit it until some better hypothesis be found out. In other words, We should always pick the best hypothesis in science. You're dealing with things you cannot measure or see, particularly the past. You always have to think about hypotheses. You know, you don't have a fact. It's not empirical right there. Until you develop a time machine, it's not empirical. So this is inference to the best explanation. And even in geology, a famous geologist, perhaps none of you know him, Charles Lyell, said, the principle of geology is being able to attempt to explain the former changes of the Earth's surface in reference to causes now in operation. That's all you can do, because you haven't seen it. So, unfortunately, now here's the real problem. Scientists nowadays ascribe to something called methodological naturalism. Even if, I'll explain what that means, even if there is a religious or spiritual explanation, and it makes sense more than the explanations they're coming up with, they reject it out of hand. But that's not really what science is. And science wasn't like that 100 or 200 years ago. This is how scientists look at it. It's also how people who study religion in the universities look at it. Isn't it true, Adi? Yeah, it's a methodological atheism, right? You know, that these people couldn't be experiencing what they are, and, you know, even if they are experiencing what they think they are, it's all an illusion anyway. Let's examine it from an external viewpoint, or as Prabhupada said, like licking on the outside of a jar of honey. All right, you look at this cartoon. Here's this guy who got crushed to death by an elephant. But because they refuse to admit that the elephant crushed him to death, they're looking for another cause. You know, so it's, and the elephant's standing right there. So God is the elephant in the room, so to speak. You know, it's obvious, you know, if you see something designed, as you see later on, I have a cartoon, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. You know, if it looks like it's designed, this computer looks like it's designed, quacks, no, it doesn't quack, but acts like it's designed, it's designed. And the computer is infinitely less complex than one cell in any of our bodies. So think about that for a second. Well, anyway, we'll get to more science. So Richard Dawkins, who is actually a famous atheist, perhaps the most famous, says, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. That's how he defines biology. In other words, he's actually admitting it looks like it's designed. So, and here's Francis Crick, who is actually another famous scientist. He discovered the double helix of DNA. He says, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. In other words, you're looking at something, it looks like it's designed, but you've got to keep reminding yourself, it's not designed. It's not designed. That's constantly keep it in your mind. I mean, that's not having an open mind, is it? Does anyone know? No. Yes, no, maybe. Anyway, it's not having an open mind. So Srila Prabhupada, of course, was a little negative about Darwin, a little negative. What is this theory? We kick out Darwin's philosophy. The more we kick out Darwin's philosophy, the more we make advancement in spiritual consciousness. And I'll explain why. This is not simply my fanatic Hare Krishna follower Srila Prabhupada discussion here. So let's talk about the different aspects of nature which are examined by scientists. Obviously, you know, we talk about earth, water, fire, air, and in science, it's called solid, liquid, gas, or plasma. If you don't know what plasma is, then we can show you someday with the electricity. We can create a plasma for you. Yeah, a spark, there's plasma there. Anyway, So nowadays, there's actually a fourth element in addition to fifth, in addition to these four which I just showed you, and that's information. Information. I mean, the computers are based upon information. As you see, the zeros and one, that's a digital computer. So now we must describe where information comes. If we see information, if we see digital data, if we see a computer program, then we have to explain not only what does it do, but where did it come from, who wrote. And if anyone writes computer programs, you know that different programmers, they leave a signature. You know, sometimes that's why they. It's interesting that when the Americans try to trace out who's hacking our computers, they can actually figure out where it comes from, because there's certain groups of Russians who leave a particular signature. So, with scientific information in the past, we were limited by optical instruments. We're talking about biology now, which only had a little bit of resolving power. So here's the comparison of different instruments and ability to resolve. That means to see tiny things with a naked eye. Phew. Then you can see, I guess, up to a piece of hair, not the cross section of the hair. And then with a optical microscope, you can see lactobacillus. It's pretty nice. And then with electron microscope, you can see DNA for the first time. So, anyway, so before the discovery of these scientific instruments, in Darwin's time, this is what they thought life was, the cell is not composed of any organs. You know, the cell doesn't have any organs. This is what Darwin thought, but consists entirely of shapeless, simple, homogeneous matter, nothing more than a shapeless, mobile, little lump of mucus or slime. Consisting of albuminous combination of carbon. And here's a picture that they took of what they thought is protoplasm, of course. So each and every cell in your body looks like that if you take a microscope. No, it doesn't. But anyway, it looks like the blob. It's pretty scary. But that's not what it looks like. They thought it was just a blob of protoplasm, but the cell is actually quite complex. You know, there's the nucleus with the DNA and then the mitochondria and all sorts of things floating around, which we don't have time to talk about. And generally, the most important thing we can talk about right now is what's called protein molecules. Now, protein forms the building blocks of life in many different ways. So really, if we're going to talk about life, we have to talk about how do protein molecules come about? And protein molecules are comprised of 20, or if you talk to some scientists, 21 different amino acids. Okay? And a small protein molecule has, very small one, has 150, roughly 150 amino acids arranged in a particular sequence. You got 20, you know, if you think mathematically, you can think about, you know, all the permutations and everything, like 20 different amino acids, or 21, you know, like A, B, C, D, like that. Some proteins have thousands or 10,000 amino acids. And the arrangement of these amino acids, because of the molecular bonds and attraction and repulsion that they have, make the protein form a particular shape. And when it forms that shape, that gives its utility. It's the shape of the protein. Remember that. Because Some of the amino acids attract, some of them form bonds, some of them repulse each other. And if you can picture in your mind in three dimensions, like we have here, it'll form a particular form that enables it to do something. The shape determines its function. Remember that. And the shape is determined by the repulsion or attractive forces between the amino acids. And so there's different types of proteins. There's enzymes. Enzymes are like catalysts, you know, that act and they don't get changed. They act in reactions. There's proteins that make structure in your body. There's proteins that send signals. We'll get into that. Regulatory proteins, transport things from one part of the body, one part of the cell to another. sensory proteins, like in your eye, motor proteins. That's the kinesin. He's a motor protein. He's a little thing that walks around the cell. Defense proteins and storage proteins. These are different varieties of proteins because there's motor proteins. An example is this is the ATP-producing combination of proteins in the mitochondria, and it produces the energy source of the cell, which is called ATP, and it revolves, and it actually has these molecules that go through it and transport and transfers it or transforms into ATP, which is the energy source of the cell. It's a whole motor composed of proteins. Each of those colored parts is a different protein that fits together because of its shape, because of its arrangement of amino acids, and it fits together perfectly. Now, if that's not design, I don't know what is. Anyway, but this is not the point. It's actually a video. I forgot that this was a video. See it producing the ATP? It pumps protons. Can you pump protons? Pretty cool. And this is just like one of millions and billions of devices in the cell. Each and every one of your cells has many of these in it. It has pumps in it. Each and every cell. And there's trillions of cells or whatever in your body. And they're messenger proteins, which don't work so well when there's a coronavirus. But anyway, I sent something to Australia 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, hasn't gotten there yet. So that's a problem. There's catalyst proteins that help with different reactions. Like lactose is an example of a catalyst protein. Helps you digest milk. Some of the people are lactose deficient, so they can't digest milk. There are structural proteins to help build things. There's hair protein. You know, hair is protein. I don't have too much protein up there, but there's nothing I can do about it. That's a structural protein, you know, the hair. There's antibody proteins. antibodies, I don't know if I want to get into all this, but antibodies are proteins that bind to a specific antigen, like the coronavirus or something like that, and has a specific shape, so it binds to it. That's why the proteins need to have a particular shape. And this is immunoglobulin G, anyway. And they have regulatory proteins, estrogen. Estrogen, you ladies know about that. You have signaling proteins that say stop, go, slow down. You have opinines in the eye that help you see. And you have transport proteins. One of them is hemoglobin, and storage proteins, which you mentioned before, like casein helps store things. Whew. And, you know, ones that form muscles. And so, just to reiterate, this is a long presentation anyway. But it's interesting, for me at least. So three features of proteins are the shapes determine the function. The folded chains form the shapes due to the attraction and repulsion. And as I said before, it has to be precise amino acid sequencing that determines what it looks like, because certain amino acids attract, certain repulse, certain form bonds. It's 3D specificity, as you see here. This is just very, very simple. So, you know, in other words, it's a 3D thing and has to be very specific to form, to perform its function. So the question we need to ask is, how common are functional sequences, you know, a protein that's functional, among all the possible combinations of amino acids? This involves a little mathematics here. So let's start out not with a protein, but let's start out with your bicycle lock. So you have four dials and with 10 digits on each dial, and so you have 10 to the 4 possible combinations, which is 10,000. So if I want to steal your bicycle, I have to be around for quite a long time, right? Probably, I could probably do it in 4 or 5 hours, most likely. 4 or 5 hours if you have a bicycle. But if you have a bicycle lock with 10 dials and 10 digits, each one has 10 digits, you have 10 billion possible combinations. And let's see, the calculation, which I wrote down here, it would take as long as 317 days. But on the average, it would be 153 days. I think it'd be easier just to make the money and buy a bike. You got to be a really determined thief to do that. And you'd be trying a combination every second. This is the point. You know, you have to get a time sequence here. So you know, we're talking about finding a functional needle in a combinatorial haystack. In other words, all these different combinations that could occur. How many would be functional? And not only are we talking about functional, but have to fulfill a specific function, which is very difficult to come by. So this particular individual is expert in languages, and he tried, with a computer actually, trying to go through different permutations of words and see which words actually make sense when you move one letter, move it around a little bit. You know, that's like a mutation in a word. He said, no existing formal language can tolerate random changes in the symbol sequences which express it in sentences. Meaning is almost invariably destroyed. He's from MIT, and that's very respectable. So here's a very simple sequence, amino acid sequence, and this is expressed in a two-dimensional form. And there's 150 amino acids. And so to come up with this by chance, it would be 10 to the 195th power that was worked out. Whew. This is a simple one. And it only has a few amino acids. There's only 20 amino acids, but there's a combination of 150 amino acids in its chain. And so the odds of getting that combination by chance, a simple protein, there are 150 sites with 20 amino acids means 20 to 150th power, which works out in base 10 as 1 times 10 to the 195th combinations. That's a lot. Whew. That means one possibility, if you have to try 10 to the 195th possible combination. If you don't know what scientific notation is, you put 1 with 195 zeros after it. That's a big number. I don't think we have a name for that number, do we? I mean, I get up to quintillion, quadrillion. After that, it's a lot. That's the only name I have for it. So we have to figure out, you know, how rare are functional sequences. So in other words, functional sequences are extremely rare. Functional folds of a given length, number of sequences of a given length, so it's 1 over 10 to the 74th. So the chances of finding a functional protein by chance is computing how many particles are there in the universe, how many seconds since the Big Bang, and how many events occurred since the beginning of the universe. And you get to the chance of one functional protein happening by chance is 1 over 10 to the 164th power. That means 1 over 1 with 164 zeros after it. That's a lot. The chance, it'd be within the span of the whole universe, according to the scientists. That does not leave us much room for, you know, everything forming by chance. It's roughly the same chance as having a tornado hit a junkyard and ending up with a flyable 747. That would be pretty cool. You don't even get a model plane out of a tornado. Let's speak of a 747. So in other words, information from the outside, and we're not talking about God right now, although we should, but information from the outside is required to form proteins. It's just practical. Where does that information come from? That's another subject matter. So anyway, so talking about DNA, it codes for the proteins. To get into little specifics, DNA has ACTG, you know, four different coding bases in it. And depending on, it's a double strand, depending on how it's coded, it comes up with different amino acids in a strand and determines ultimately the protein to be formed. So it's exactly the same as computer code, except it's not binary. I guess you could call it quadrinary or something like that would be the proper term. We use binary computers generally. Of course, quantum computers are different. We're not talking about that. But the computers that you use, that I'm using right now, is a binary computer. It functions on the basis of ones and zeros. But this type of computer, the DNA computer, functions on the basis of four different bases. You know, you've got four choices. You can arrange them in any sequence you want. Anyway, so it's computer code. And here, Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, say the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Apart from the differences in jargon, the pages of a molecular biology journal might be interchanged with those of a computer engineering journal. And not only that, but talking about computer programming, if you don't know too much about it, you'll actually find nested programming within the genes. You'll find compression, you know, like everybody knows about zip files. And he says, human DNA is like a computer program, but far more advanced than anything we've ever created. That's from Bill Gates, of course, not from Dawkins. And here's the symptoms of a computer program, in case you don't know. Nested coding of information, files within folders that are hierarchical. You know, for those of you who are more intelligent and don't use Apple computers, you know what I'm talking about. And Apple computers, you don't know what hierarchy is. It's just like, this is a free-for-all. But someone who's actually intelligent and uses a PC knows better. So, it's true, isn't it? You use an Apple computer? My condolences. So, you know, the PC, it's actually much more, I mean, your approach to the PC is much more hierarchical. The Apple computer is hierarchical, but you're shielded from it. It's just like you see little figures and you figure, oh, that looks like a document. And you press on it. But I don't do that. I go into the folder, the subfolder, and the sub-subfolder, and that's how I access my data. It's like a filing cabinet. So that's how DNA functions, and the proteins function. It's like a filing cabinet. You've got directories, subdirectories, sub-subdirectories. It's nested, and you have distributed storage and retrieval information modules. Incredible. And, of course, one of the arguments that people say that people who are in favor of, let's say, unintelligent design, say that, well, what do you do about all the junk DNA? They say most of the DNA doesn't code. Well, it turns out that the junk DNA actually is the operating system. Just like if you go into a computer, most of the stuff in the computer is not the data that you have in it. You know, not that the PowerPoint presentation you have in it. Most of the stuff you have in the computer is actually the operating system. It's far larger than all your music files. So there's no junk DNA. As the scientists investigate more, there's no junk DNA. The junk DNA actually is the operating system. And then you have design patterns that indicate some intelligence, you know, patterns of design. So, okay, go quickly. So how does the DNA manufacture the protein? This is quite interesting because we talk about the four bases of the DNA. And here we will see. I took my camera inside a nucleus one time. Swam around a little bit. So then what you got here is copying. It's copying, actually, the DNA into the RNA. RNA is, that's called messenger RNA. And it's interesting, the coronavirus is an RNA virus. It's a messenger RNA, not just an RNA, but it's a messenger RNA virus, which really screws up your whole genetic structure. And then also the vaccines they're coming up with are messenger RNA vaccines. Anyway, so the nucleus opens up. You know, there's a little hole, many holes in the nucleus. They open up to let the RNA out. This is messenger RNA. And it somehow or other finds its way. To, I think it's the Golgi apparatus. Anyway, so it's, and then it gets transferred. Now you have the transfer RNA. It transfers the information and assembles the different proteins down there. So the transfer RNA assembles the different proteins. And then reads it like, you know, a computer reader. There's the protein coming out in a specific shape. Then the protein goes on its way, and it gets shaped more. What was it? I think it's the Golgi apparatus that shapes. Yeah, the Golgi apparatus shapes it. It's already potentially of a certain shape because of the attractions and repulsions between the different amino acids. And then it's ready for action. It's let out into the big world to do its thing. And there you have the birth of a protein. Pretty good, isn't it? And all this is happening inside the cell in addition to billions of other things. So, yeah, it's actually the ribosomes that synthesize the proteins, and it's the Golgi apparatus that actually shapes them after that. And then you have the mRNA is the messenger RNA, and you'll see that term used a lot in relationship to the virus and relationship to the vaccines that are being manufactured right now. They're messenger RNA. In other words, it tells your cells how to manufacture certain things, how to manufacture antibodies, actually, against the coronavirus. But it also can really screw you up if they got the wrong. This is the first time they're coming up with mRNA vaccines. And it's never been done before in human beings. So, and then the protein that is meant to be used is taken in a vesicle, means a little capsule, and transported to wherever it's supposed to be used. These things have brains. Must be. And here's the Golgi apparatus, which I described before, shapes the protein. Anyway, it is so incredibly complex in there. It's one gene. Okay. So here's a quote. Theories of prebiotic natural selection need information, which implies they have to be presuppose what is explained in the first place. In other words, if you're going to come up with prebiotic natural selection, it's impossible because prebiotic elements, that means before you start talking about biology, doesn't function according to natural selection. You know, water doesn't function according to natural selection. Oxygen doesn't. But it's biological entities that function according to natural selection. So then you also have the question of where life came from in the first place. And how can lifeless matter develop into matter with life? Because evolution, according to the scientists, can only take place, or survival of the fittest, can only take place when you have life and coding mechanisms such as DNA. So Crick, interesting, came up with a very interesting speculation. And when he came up with a speculation, he lost his Nobel Prize. Because he was wondering how it was possible that nature created at the same time two mutually interdependent elements to give rise to life. In other words, you need life to give rise to life. So how could nature produce these things? It's impossible. Even Crick realized that. And so then Crick saw that it was impossible for all the interdependent mechanisms to arise by chance. And so then he came up with this amazing speculation. He called it directed panspermia, which means that there was deliberate transport of microorganisms in space from species on other planets. Now, that's not completely wrong, because we also talk about how demigods and all that other stuff do things. So it's called directed panspermia. And he said organisms, this is Francis Crick, one of the discoverers of the double helix, were deliberately transmitted to Earth by intelligent beings on another planet. We concur that it is possible that life reached the Earth in this way. So this was his speculation. So, we accept it. But he lost his Nobel Prize because of that. They thought he's a jerk, you know. He's lost his mind. Came up with some good theories, but then later on he blew it, you know. Must have been smoking something after that. So as far as, you know, life coming from life, this is the most plausible explanation. And as we said before, if it walks and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So it's the best possible explanation. I mean, until someone comes up with another explanation, then we'll accept it. But based upon the current state of biology and evolutionary theory and scientific information, there's no practical way to explain, no logical way to explain that life developed or life or different life forms came about through this process which they call natural selection. However, most modern scientists refuse to even think about this possible explanation that life came about by design, because they are actually advocates of a methodological naturalism, as we mentioned before. So anyway, and so this is called cognitive dissonance in psychological language. Cognitive dissonance means that you see something and you're told by, oh my God, I shouldn't bring him into this talk. You're told by the President of the United States it's a walrus. And the Dunning theory or something like that? I forget. It's a different cognitive theory they came up with. If you tell a lie enough times, people believe it. A Dunning something theory. And it was applied to the President of the United States. You know, if you keep telling people enough times, the lie becomes truth. And Prabhupada talked about that too when they wanted to convince Gopal Bhan that he had become a ghost. You know this story? That Gopal Bhan, the king was very upset with Gopal Bhan. He wanted to just trick him. And he told everybody to tell Gopal Bhan that you become a ghost. So Gopal Bhan was walking down, and everybody said, you become a ghost, you become a ghost, you become a ghost, you become a ghost. And finally, he believed it. I become a ghost. So if you repeat a lie enough times, people will believe it. So that's called cognitive dissonance. Refusing to believe what's the most plausible explanation in this particular case. So where does the information come from that I am presenting? Of course, from scientists. But actually, this information comes from the Vedic literatures, which talk about Lord Vishnu creating the universe. Brahma gave him he gave Brahma the intelligence to create different living entities and to do all this stuff. And Lord Brahma empowered others in this disciplic succession to help the conditioned souls realize the purpose of the material world and become unbound from the material energy. And he established these different disciplic successions. Krishna established different disciplic successions. And, we have Srila Prabhupada and Prabhupada with the different universal explanations, which I'm not going to get to right now. And, of course, We all want to go back to the spiritual world where life comes from life. And there's no dead matter in the spiritual world. And we want to worship Radha Golokananda. Anyway, so that's a basic presentation. I mean, we can go on forever with this. I have other presentations about de-evolution. And I can recommend, if anyone's interested, I can recommend perhaps 30 different scientific books on the subject matter. Everything from irreducible complexity to cellular biology to, let's see, what else? Studies on DNA and RNA, structure of the universe. I mean, I have a tremendous amount of books on these subject matters that are produced by scientists, some of whom have gone to Cambridge, like our friend here, who's going to Cambridge. Yeah, actually the head of one of the main intelligent design institutions got his PhD in Cambridge. Yeah, Stephen Meyer. And he's a scientist, but he also studied the philosophy of science. So the problem with most scientists is they don't really know philosophy. They know science, which is fine, you know, at least their branch of science, but they don't know these different philosophical points and what's, you know, they don't know the definition of science that I just gave, you know. Coming up with the best explanation based upon limited data. I mean, they don't really know about these things. It's just, it's very interesting. They're not at all philosophical, most of the scientists. So, if anyone's interested, doesn't believe me, read some books. I got tons of books. I can give you the books for free. I have them on my computer. You can read them, be convinced, and fail at the university when you present the information to your professors. You will have to leave the university. There's actually a very interesting video. And what is the name of that video? It's Expelled, No Intelligence. What is that? Expelled, No Intelligence? Yeah, and something like Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. And it's about different scientists who differed. And now we're talking about archaeology, basically, and anthropology, who differed with the accepted theories. And they just lost their position in the university just because they had different opinions. And therefore, there's this mechanism called knowledge filter in science. And I know because I studied science. That was my science and math, that was my field. Knowledge filter means that if you come up with evidence, which in anthropology or archaeology is called anomalous evidence, then people reject that evidence even if it's incontrovertible evidence. People reject that evidence because it goes against the accepted theories. I mean, just like if, you know, Galileo said, well, the sun is in the center and the earth goes around it, you know, people rejected it, even though that's a fact. I mean, of course, you can calculate how the earth is in the center, but then it's all these complex movements if you have to calculate in that way. Extremely complex movements, you know, that are circles and eights and things like that. So we have to be careful about this political correctness in science. And we should keep an open mind to other explanations. That's all. And, of course, if you're a Hare Krishna devotee, you have to believe what I say. No, you're not. If you're a Hare Krishna devotee, keep an open mind. We're not trying to impose some dogma on people. Keep an open mind. Look at both sides. And I've looked at both sides. I mean, I wouldn't accept, because of my science background, I do not accept things blindly. I look at both sides. I look at scientifically. I look at it mathematically. My training is in mathematics, multidimensional calculus, physics, probability theory. You know, that's the training I got in the university. And so that's how I look at it, not from a religious perspective. I pull myself away from my religious perspective and look at it in a detached way, and then I come up with the same conclusion. Okay. Yes, Aditya. Yeah.
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 So at what point would the mutation or crossbreeding
become suspect? It's not that you're creating a new species, you're mixing the species. Generally, a species is determined by ability to mate with another entity. That's one scientific definition of species. Like if one particular animal can mate with another animal, sometimes they can say, that's one definition. There are other definitions of species. And you're creating cross species, you know, I guess, what is it, the horse and the donkey or something like that? They get an ass.
You can mess the chromosome number also.
What?
You can mess the chromosome numbers.
They have to match chromosome numbers, yeah. Yeah, they have to match chromosome numbers. So, I mean, you're not really getting new species. You're mixing and matching. Even Krishna does that. He mixed and he matched and he got half man, half lion. Yeah, there's no problem with mixing and matching. And also with plants, you know, there's genetic. Of course, nowadays people are making their own species with GMO stuff, you know. That's another problem. Just reading an article today how the vegetarians are very happy because they're going to be manufacturing meat in the laboratory. But then it turns out that in order to manufacture meat in the laboratory, you need to kill a calf while it's still in its inside the mother cow and take the blood from the fetal blood from a calf, and then you can manufacture anyway. So it's cruelty there. Yes, Rishikesh.
I just wanted to understand this temple of Vedic Pandorium when we are trying to assimilate this multidimensional universe into a three-dimensional form, I mean, three-dimensional way.
Yeah.
Is it going to be possible at all?
No. You want to know my honest opinion as a scientist? They can show the teleological, it can be a teleological hierarchy, but not a... You can't really picture, except in a metaphorical sense, what's happening. That's right. They've come to that conclusion, actually, about the chandelier and everything, which I told them about several years ago, that you're not going to be able to depict something that has that many dimensions in three dimensions, or something that's of a far subtler nature. You can do something teleological. Teleological means showing the purpose of each level. That's practical. But if you try to, you know, if you try to depict three dimensions on a two-dimensional piece of paper, you can do it to a certain extent. Or let's say a one-dimensional piece of paper, if you can get a one-dimensional. Yeah, it's not possible. There's many more dimensions than we are, that we have access to. I mean, this world is multidimensional, and there's a lot of objective reality that you can't prove ourselves, you know, objective reality that you can't prove, that you have to accept as an axiom. Therefore, you know, Descartes, when he was coming up with his philosophy, accepted as an axiom something he couldn't prove, which is, you know, cogito ergo sum. I am conscious, therefore I am. That's, you know, it's axiom. How do you prove it? You can't prove it. Right? Does everybody know what I'm talking about? Cogito ergo sum. Therefore, most lay people translate it as I think, therefore I am, but I think it's better I'm conscious, therefore I am. Because some people don't think, and they still are. So, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, because I guess Kolke introduces some new genes or something. I mean, you'd have to talk to Kolke about that. But I suggest you read this one book about, Darwin Devolves is the name. It's a Michael Behe. It's really good. I mean, really complex. You have to have a scientific mind to read it. But it's really good. Scientific mathematics. Really fantastic. Actually, there's several books that were written recently in that vein by scientists showing how the genome is actually devolving rather than evolving. And then usually when a bacteria, this is interesting, when a bacteria gets some immunity from some antibiotic or something like that, it's usually due to a loss of some functionality in its genome. Not something added, but a loss of sensitivity to a particular, particular antibiotic. And yeah, that's a type of a de-evolution or evolution. Generally, we see de-evolution rather than evolution. People are all I can say is you should read these books. I don't have time to explain all the details of it, nor am I as expert as these scientists are in explaining these things. Yeah. Yeah, and also, Bill Gates also said the same thing.
But isn't that, directly indicating that the scientists...
Yeah.
But
he said it has all the signs of a computer program. I don't know if that's the exact quote. Let me go back. No, that's Francis Crick's. It's way back. I think it's way back. Yeah, the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Apart from the differences in jargon, the pages of a molecular biology journal might be interchanged with those of a computer engineering journal. I mean, but he's ignoring the logical, what's happening logically. He says all the designs, all the uncannily computer-like. And he's like the world's greatest or lousiest atheist. And I mean, what can you say? It's a computer program. Have you ever seen a computer program evolve by itself? I mean, in the future you're going to have computers that can write their own programs. I understand that. But, original program, I don't think there's ever been a computer program that evolved by itself. If you look at the Matrix, you'll think like that. Matrix? No. Nobody's seen the Matrix? And actually, there's other theories that some scientists actually say that we're in a virtual reality right now. And we actually say the same thing. We're actually in a virtual reality. We're not here. We're not these bodies. We're not actually in touch with matter. The super soul and the soul are not actually in touch with matter. We're driving the bodies. Just like one drives an avatar in a computer simulation. We're in a simulation. Anyway, simulation. In the future, they'll have these. They do actually already have the glasses you put on, and you can feel like you're in this virtual world. And later on, they'll have, you'll be able to smell. They'll have artificial smell coming out because there's certain chemicals that it can emulate almost any smell. So they just have a bunch of these chemicals inside a machine. You have artificial smell, or even better, you just plug into the computer. But in any case, we are plugged into this material world. And we have to take the red pill, which is Krishna consciousness, and become liberated from this entanglement that we have, this attachment. All right, I think we've gone online. Do you have any announcements for everybody? I mean, on the
on my TV show. No. Anyway, want to thank everybody for watching today. Got a lot of people watching. Oh, we got 15 chat. I don't think I have time to answer the chats. Someone said, listening to the class, I felt like I was in a biology class at the university, sitting clueless, trying to understand, feeling dumb. And Jagat said, it's all right, you don't need to know this stuff unless you're trying to convince someone about it. Anyway, someone commented about junk files. There are no junk files. Well, there may be some files that have been discarded for one reason or other, but primarily what the scientists call junk files, they're actually used for the operating system in the cell. Because you need an operating system. It just doesn't happen. Like another thing that really I thought was really cool in the cell is that you have this DNA, and sometimes the DNA gets tangled, just like all of you have experienced that when you have wires like this, you just let them sit. They tie themselves in knots. You ever experienced that? And you just think, who is directing these wires to tie themselves in knots? So, but it happens naturally. That's not a biological function. So it ties itself in knots, so the DNA sometimes gets tangled. And so what happens is there's another mechanism in the cell, which is a scissors, and it cuts the DNA to untangle it, and then there's a glue mechanism that glues it back together. And there's an error correction mechanism too. Just like in a digital computer, you have error correction. So there's error correction in the DNA strand. I mean, it's pretty amazing. When you examine microbiology, it's hard not to come to the conclusion that someone designed the thing. You know, it's just like, even over the span of billions and trillions of years, I mean, of course, not trillions, billions of years, it just couldn't have come about by chance. It just, you know, it just doesn't make sense. Okay, I think we have to end now. And thank you all for joining us. And it's nice to see people in the temple. Social distancing, they're trying their best to social distance. And now you know what messaging RNA is. And you know the vaccine, what it will be. It will take over your cells. That's why people are talking how it's people are scared of it. This particular type of previous vaccines have been, you know, you take the virus and you kill it. And then virus is already dead. And the virus is not alive to begin with, but somehow or other you diffuse it with radiation or some other means, and then you inject the virus that can no longer replicate. A virus is just a few strands of DNA or RNA. That's what virus is. Virus is not a cell. A virus takes over your cells. So when you have this coronavirus, it takes over your cells and injects its own RNA into the cells and produces its own proteins. And that's its destructive factor. So the vaccine is also, most of the vaccines are messenger RNA, which also take over some of the reproductive mechanisms of the cell. So, Franken-cells. Okay. But I'll be the first one to take the vaccine. I have faith in science. Okay. I guess that's it. All glories. Interesting discussion. And we'll get back to the Bhagavad Gita tomorrow night. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. All right. Thank you all for joining us. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. That's what I was looking for. Dunning-Kruger effect is if you tell a lie enough times, it becomes believable. Dunning-Kruger.